reserve them. We have 15 minutes for you. Do you wish to reserve any for rebuttal?
3 minutes, Your Honor.
3 minutes for rebuttal.
Great. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Hopefully there's not as much public interest in this case as the last one. But, I'm going to do three things right now. Number one, I'm going to debunk what I think is the appellee's view of the record in this case. Number two, I want to make clear what the law is. Number three, I want to tell you, the court, what I think you all ought to do. The bottom line is, I think this court needs to make clear that a spouse's equity percentage in a closely held business is not a proxy for proving causation of increased value of a mixed asset as a matter of law. I think this court needs to make that crystal clear because I think this opinion shows there's confusion out there in the law about that.
Say that again slowly.
Sure, I talk fast. I think this court ought to make clear that a spouse's equity percentage in a closely held business is not a proxy, a substitute for proving causation of separate marital interest in a mixed asset as a matter of law. So I don't think a court can just look at an equity percentage in a business and say, you don't have to put on any evidence to prove anything else. The equity percentage is a proxy to prove how much the increase in value, how you apportion that. That's what the court did here, okay? First of all, I want to sort of just walk you through what was not in the record, because the appellee spent probably 80% of their brief reciting facts of which, if you read the letter opinion, was entirely rejected. It was entirely rejected. In the brief, Judge Klein, with a 37-page single-spaced opinion, which is typical of Judge Klein, but he went through and rejected all this evidence they cite. First of all, with regard to Joe Baer's credibility, the appellee's credibility, the judge wrote, "No testimony by Mr. Joe Baer Kenzel provided a sound factual predicate for the analysis undertaken and presented by his expert." That's what the court held. They wrote in their opinion that the court found the husband to be credible. That's a stretch. What the judge said was also, although the court found Joe Baer to be generally credible during this aspect of the trial, Joe Baer did not differentiate between the extent of his contribution to RLM, the closely held business, as to the contribution of others before the marriage, during the marriage, or after separation. So in other words, he was credible. Nothing he gave me was of any help trying to figure out how to apportion the gain in this $2-3 million asset. Number three, Judge Klein also pointed out another phase in the opinion early on when he was talking about valuation of the business. The information supplied by Mr. Joe Baer to Rosenberg and even so to Martin, his retained expert, they had this joint expert they hired and they had this retained expert, Martin. He said the court found the information supplied by Joe Baer to be less than entirely credible after full consideration of the entirety of the trial testimony of Joe Baer, Kanzella, who was the business partner, Martin, and Rosenberg, the two experts. Number five, you got to remember that the appellee has cited repeatedly in his brief to this testimony of this business partner, Kanzella. Kanzella, who at trial, it was disclosed, was basically given a list of questions and answers he was supposed to answer to the night before trial. There's a long section of the testimony where he goes through, counsel had him pull out his phone, and he read 78 different questions on his phone and the answers he was supposed to give. So, I mean, the court was not paying a whole lot of attention to this stuff. Number six, you got to remember in terms of the credibility given to what the appellee said, this is a person who took the position at trial that a business that pays him over $1 million a year, he could only sell his interest for $1.6 million. The court found that, he said the validity of that position was self-evident, which in other words, bogus. And the idea that you can only sell something that pays you $1 million a year for $1.6 million in perpetuity, that's crazy. The appellee also tried to say the court gave Joe Baer's expert, Martin's, some kind of weight in deciding how to apportion this. The court didn't do that. If you read the opinion, the letter opinion, very carefully, the court spent like four paragraphs going through debunking every single last aspect of what Martin said. It said that Martin was incredible, that he was testifying to please his who hired him, as most experts, as many experts do, that he said his opinions weren't based in sound economics, that there wasn't a sound factual predicate for anything. I mean, there's like five paragraphs in this 37-page letter opinion. The key part is about four pages in terms of the only issue we're fighting about on appeal here. But he went through and debunked this entire thing. So at the very end, you know, what Judge Klein held was that all of this was of little help to him as a trial judge trying to figure out what to do with this situation, which is why he went on and said, well, I don't have any evidence I can use, so I'm just going to look at how much, what percentage Mr. Joe Barron owned compared with his other partners. I'm just going to use that.
Well, counsel, he did say, I'll give you that it was an odd letter of opinion that went into a lot of what the judge didn't believe and what what the judge didn't find useful. But didn't he also say he's reviewed all of the evidence, he's aware of all the evidence, and has considered all the evidence?
He said that after we filed a motion to reconsider, pointing out that his conclusions were illogical.
After fixing his math.
Right, after he claims
fixing
he made a $700,000 math error, reduced my client's...
No, absolutely. I get it. This is definitely an odd record.
Right, but he wrote right here on page 1384, page 19 of the letter opinion, based on the lack of other persuasive evidence, this court finds that his proportionate share of the ownership of the business should govern the classification issue. If he found that the ownership percentage governs how you classify the gain in that asset, that isn't the law, and it also just belies any kind of like logic.
Can I ask you, counsel? Uh-huh. Your argument isn't that he had to go with 100% necessarily, right? It's just you can't go with 30% of 30% just because 30% is the portion of the business or that you own.
Right. I mean, listen, I'm in a law firm. I got five partners. We each own 20%. And, you know, the idea that the increase of our business over the last 10 years is just equal because we're all equal partners is crazy. Some of us give them more than others. Some of us have better practices than others. Some of us are more, you know, well-known than others. the value of the business is a function of a lot of different variables, not just because we're all equal owners. And I think what the court did was it looked at what this court held in the Roe case. In the Roe case, where I think it was a 50-50 deal, and then there was the Decker case where there was five equity holders, and they said, well, one of five, 20%.
Decker, no relation.
Right, good point. But I think the court tried to read between the lines in those cases and said, well, the appellate courts have sort of looked at these equity percentages in other cases, and it seems like they've affirmed those cases, and so we should use that here. And that's if you read the cases carefully, that's not what they hold at all. I mean, first of all, you got to remember that Decker was decided before the statute was amended in 1993, I think. The opinion came down in 93, but the case was argued and presented, like, I think in 91. Then it went up on appeal, and there was a little bit of an argument about retroactivity. But that standard was not the standard. On Decker, the burden of proof hadn't shifted. That's what that new statute changed. And I think that the General Assembly's use of the word causation is absolutely critical in this case, because the word causation only appears two places in 20-107.3. It says, number one, it says that the trial court can use a different valuation date for good cause shown. The only other place it appears is on this issue, that who has the burden to show the increase in value of separate asset and that it becomes marital, who has the burden to disprove that, which is the appellee. And so I think one of the errors that the appellee makes in his argument, both in terms of trying to say what your honor just needs to find some evidence and you can affirm, or that, you know, this is exercise of discretion, you can affirm. So we're not talking about a situation where you got 11 equitable distribution factors and you just say, well, you know, there's a little bit of evidence supporting each one as an exercise of discretion. They have to show causation. And when it comes to causation, the Supreme Court has been really clear that causation, as a matter of law, is a much more complex analysis and actually gives you all an opportunity to get outside the box of, you know, divorce and workers' comp and criminal law and look at some other cases about, for example, business, how to prove business profits, how to prove business gain in value, how to prove, you know, gain in value of other assets, how to, you know, causation in the personal injury world. Proving causation, okay, the Supreme Court has written a lot of opinions about it, actually, in the last 3 or 4 years now, especially in the products liability arena. But proving causation and meeting that burden of proof, it's a much higher burden than just putting on some evidence and the court exercising its discretion and announcing a decision, right? And so... And the court acknowledged this. If you read, the letter opinion, the court complained about this and said...
What page are you on?
On the letter opinion? Mm-hmm. On page 18.
That's okay. The last one, right?
Yeah, 18 of the amended letter opinion.
Of the amended.
1383 of the record. But the second to last paragraph on the bottom of the page, it says, if the present language of 20-107.3... and the Supreme Court's decision of David have constructed an unduly onerous burden on an owner's spouse, the appellee, in this context, any solution must be left to the wisdom of the General Assembly. as only the legislative branch holds the power to amend the statute. It's not within the province of the trial court to either rewrite a statute or effectively overrule a decision of the highest court in the state. What he's saying is, that's a really high burden to meet. You know, the judge went through like four pages of, you know, yeah, he put on all this evidence, but none of it makes any sense or gives me any help.
But then he says he met. Then he says he met it.
Then he said that he's going to use the equity percentage. Then he says the equity percentage governs. He just pulls that out of his pocket and all of a sudden says the equity percentage governs this issue, which is not what this court has ever held. It's not what the Supreme Court has ever held. It's simply unfair. And I think this court needs to issue some guidance on this, because this issue, the increase in value of a separate asset during a marriage, often involves millions and millions and millions of dollars. We're talking about closely held businesses, 401ks, bank accounts. I mean, and what's out there right now is not really guidance. It's you got David, Roe, and Decker, pretty much. And they have some factual analogies you can make, but not any clear standards of what you have to show to prove causation of what is an economic type of problem. And so that's why I think this court needs to make clear that an equity percentage is not a proxy for proving causation of the increased value of a mixed asset as a matter of law. And I think if you read,
is that really what the appellee is saying though here?
Well, what he's just saying is, well, there's evidence to support it, even though the court rejected all of it. There's evidence to support it, so you all just need to affirm, because I can point to some things in the record that the court in his letter opinion discounted. I think that's what they're saying. And they're saying, well, you know, there's a bunch of expert testimony, a bunch of testimony from the owners and some other people, and so you just need to, there's evidence to support it, leave it alone. You know, and actually, interesting, Judge Klein sort of joked about this, page 245 of the record, when the experts start testifying, he said, you know, but the easiest thing for a judge to do is to just sit here fat, dumb, and happy and say, he says the value is this, and he says the value is that, and for me to say it's just somewhere in the middle and not say anything, and the Court of Appeals is probably going to affirm it. So I don't want to do that. I don't think it's fair. And I said, I mean, that's why he wrote a 37-page letter opinion, because he wanted to explain his ruling to the people, you know, over this millions of dollars. But I think by explaining it, he over-explained it and explained himself into a box. So I see my time has expired at this point, so I'll reserve for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. All right, Mr. Steele, 15 minutes.
If it may please the court, I'm Lawrence Steele, and I'm representing Guy Joubert, the appellee. First of all, I'm going to move to dismiss the assignment of error number one. It wasn't argued, it wasn't pursued. That was just the general, I don't like the value, and I don't like how the percentage was. That wasn't pursued, and under 5A20E, I think it should be waived and dismissed. I want to argue my motion to dismiss. He's arguing things that aren't in the record. He keeps repeatedly saying that the court didn't find that Mr. Joubert had met his burden of proof under David. That was not the case. He quotes things that are critical of the passive and market increase, which was a distinct argument, rejected. That's not before this court. But when it got to the third-party effort, he said there were managers. And he didn't have to get into each of the relative testimony that was in detail in the record that he said he considered, for example, on what manager did what, some did some activities and others. This causation thing I don't think needs any clarification. As probably you all know, I wrote the statute, but that's not the issue. The issue is it, do you have to say this contract on this day created $382.26, so that increases it that? None of the cases have done that. The courts have a broad discretion in order to determine what efforts led to that increase. Now, they argue, in my motion, there was never anything that says that he rejected all of the evidence. He says there was maybe not a lot of other persuasive evidence, but that means there was persuasive evidence. And later in the motion for clarification on page 13, let's see, I forget, 13, 16 or 17, I think it is. Anyway, he said that I considered all the law. In fact, they had large discourses about the David case. The David case is the one that has clarified who has what burdens. We're not arguing that. This is not an issue of a statutory interpretation or the court's improper application of the David case. Everybody agrees. Mr. Joubert had the burden to prove what extent of the increase was due to third-party effort.
So what evidence did he provide that supports that?
Mr. Joubert?
Yes.
the testimony of the income percentages, the testimony of his 30% signing of a $800,000 loan, the percentage of their compensation return, the testimony of their duties. He had gone from a higher percentage to a lower percentage in the 20s. We had the admission of Mr. Martin's report as to this specific issue. He kind of dumps on Mr. Martin a lot, I guess I'll use that word, as to the passive market increase. He says Mr. Martin wasn't an expert, and I'm not going to listen to that evidence. Okay, but that he's using the same words to kind of extrapolate it over to the third-party effort, which he never said that. He says, I've considered all these reports. Mr. Martin himself said in his report that in his report, the percentage of the increase attributable to Mr. Joubert was 26 point something percent, if you don't consider the market. So all of the, then they got into what who did managerial financial matters, which is what Mr. Decker did. And let me ask you, I want to make a comment about Mr. Decker in that case. He criticizes the Decker case, says it's sloppy, it's not the law, it's kind of like what sticks. That was a 7-day trial, and I was the commissioner. I was the one that wrote the report that had been affirmed by the judge in the trial in this court. But that's not the issue. He says that doesn't apply at all. Decker, not only I used an analogy of the new 91 amendments in analyzing the five different Mr. Decker and then the other four major CEOs in there, and they both the Decker case said. You can use that by analogy, but not only that, since the 91 Amendment, by the time the case was tried, the 91 Amendment was in effect, even though this was filed in 89, it says, accordingly, we hold that the 91 Amendment pertaining to the burden of proof on the owning spouse, which is procedural by nature and does not affect any substantive rights, could be applied retroactively in this case. That was the basis of the analysis. The Decker case was decided using that analogy retroactively.
And your position is that Davis does not change Roe or Decker?
Absolutely not. You still have to prove the burden. In the Decker case, you had five CEOs. Mr. Decker was more the financial guy. And the court upheld a finding of 20%. The detail of the evidence in this is far superior in detail to Decker, Roe, and let me comment on Congdon. I guess I can comment on that. I was the judge pro tem in that case. The Congdon case shows that Roe doesn't say that it has to be a proxy. That's bunk. There's nothing in there that said the judge used proxy. In fact, on page 1601 and 2, at the motion for reconsideration, he says, I didn't use a proxy. I didn't just use a rote number. I didn't pull it out of the air, as he keeps arguing, falsely. The says, I looked at all of the evidence and came up with that percentage. If he was doing it just on the number of CEOs, as the judge commented, I could have done it with four CEOs, and that would have been 25%. So he says he looked at the evidence. You have to give deference to the judge that says that. But Congdon was a case where Mr. Congdon was like the low man on a family totem pole. As I recall, he had 18% or something of the stock, but the court affirmed a finding of 10% of the increase because he was kind of less. If Roe meant what they said, as interpreted by courts, this court, that it has to be a proxy percentage, which I disagree with, then it would have reversed Congdon because it wasn't the percentage of the stock. It was a different percentage based on the analysis of the factors, just like here. In Roe, they said that you have to look at the proportionate amount of stock that they own. Or proportionate to the ownership. It doesn't mean equal. So you look at all the factors. And in Roe, they looked at a lot of the factors of the two brothers and what they did. That's exactly what the evidence here. I've put in my brief a list of two or three pages of all the specifics of who owned what stock, which is a factor, who performed what function. Some were managerial. There was evidence.
And all that is in the record?
Absolutely in the record, and it's on, I think, pages...
No, I just wanted to verify that.
Absolutely in the record. For example, Mr. Joubert... hired other people who then brought in people that had clients and they were able to, what they call port, bring in a book of business, and that generated income for this patent litigation that they do. Those were efforts of third parties that would support a finding that those efforts were material to the increase in value. Again, you don't have to quantify it to say it would be an impossible burden to quantify this day I made this decision leading to this dollar. No case has ever held that in any of our cases. It's just a matter of looking at overall. This court should look at it this way. Was there an abuse of discretion of the court's finding when it says I considered all the evidence that 30% is way out of line? Is it within the range of the percentage of something that would be reasonable? And based on so many different things, the signing of co-loans, the income percentages, the income generated by them, which had decreased down to 7% at the time of trial by Mr. Joubert. Obviously, 93% of income being generated had to be generated by the efforts of somebody. And if it wasn't him, who was it? What was these other parties? So
the fact that the 30% ownership...
It's a factor.
It's a factor. But that doesn't equate, in your argument, in any way to the fact that 30% of the increase...
If that had been the only issue, I still think it could have supported it. But we have so many other factors that... Like Mr. Martin, 26.5%, the percentage of income of 23%. We have four different people that were the CEOs, 25%. So 30% is within a range of all the other types of quantitative evidence that we have here. And it's much more detailed in the record than what we see in Congdon, that we saw in Roe, and that we saw in Decker. And they didn't get into Mr. Decker's, this Mr. Jones over here did 38%, so that reduces it down. You don't look at it that way. You just look at the reality. I mean, it's a rational conclusion that other CEOs that are active, they're not straw family members that just own stock. That might be a different issue. So they did personal effort under the definition. He talks about the will of the legislature in his brief. This affirming this would exactly affirm what we were trying to do, and that is to return the marital partnership to the spouses. It was Mr. Joubert's efforts that led to the increase. And by the way, the 30-30, he owned 30% of the stock. So that initial
increase, what got everything confused. Was the
yeah,
30-30.
He's trying to confuse you and double-dip this thing. He had a value of his 30%, and the court made a finding of the increase of that. That's not an issue in terms of a factual error. So we know the increase. But that's the increase, that's the marital share, that then we have to decrease down for third-party effort. So it's not a double dip and double doing it. It's exactly the way the statute should work. There was, again, no evidence that there was a proxy. Now, he talks about Mr. Campazello, whatever his name is, about the court finding him incredible or inherently bad. Yeah, he had questions but that was given, but he says, look, I knew all the answers anyway. But the criticism was mainly on the area of passive market increases. When it got into the evidence about who did what on third-party effort, he did testify. But let's assume the court under Street versus Street, that can always weigh all of these things, says, I totally reject this gentleman's testimony. Mr. Joubert's testimony was enough. Mr. Martin's report, even their expert, Mr. Rosenberg, commented on the different types of managerial skills that each of these different owners did.
Well, the judge didn't totally discredit any of the witnesses, correct?
No. He says he did, but they didn't. He kind of discredited parts of everything. He discredited Mrs. Herbert on some of her efforts and said that even if I believe everything she did, which was in conflict about who generated certain things, that would be he didn't find that credible. He quotes a few times Mr. Martin as being outrageous or something in terms of a specific quote from the letter opinion. That was specific to a Mr. Carlin's buy-in of $450,000 when he came in and how that increased it. The judge rejected that. But he never, ever, once said, I don't believe Mr. Martin as the third-party effort. I don't believe Mr. Joubert, who generally he found credible. These are all things for the weight. So at the end of the day, when the judge says, I've considered all the evidence, you have to give credence to that, and the evidence was voluminous. This is not an issue of where the court totally rejected meeting the burden of proof. And again, David case was discussed over and over at different hearings. The judge understood David. And I think applied it. So he didn't erroneously ever say, I'm not going to use David, but I'm still going to go ahead and give her 30%. He never said that. I'd like to have him point right in the record when he gets back up here and give you the page number where he says, I don't find that David was met. It's not in there. You know, we have statutes that require certain statements to be made in writing, spousal support findings, deviation from guidelines. An equitable distribution, there's nothing that says you have to say, and I find that he met that burden. That's implied by the fact that over and over, pages, he understands David. Judge Klein's a smart judge. He understood David. He analyzed it in here. And he applied David. And it was our burden. And that's why it's not a legal issue on the statute. It's a factual issue based on that statute. And there's no issue of causation that's a problem. If Mr. Joubert had never presented any of the voluminous evidence that's in the record, it's in my brief, we'd have a problem. But this record is replete more so than just about any case. So we believe that the motion to dismiss ought to be granted because they're basing it on their allegation that the judge found that we didn't meet our burden of proof. There's nothing in there that says that. So I cited the, I figured the name of the case means with a G, Goje, or whatever, but you know, look at it, see if that would provide another basis for the affirmation of this decision. At the end of the day, Mr. Joubert's return of the increase is fair. It's what the marital partnership would theory would support and should be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel.
So you all have to reconcile the judge saying, I consider all the evidence with his statement at the end of the letter of opinion that based on the lack of other persuasive evidence, this court finds his proportionate share of the ownership of RLM should govern the classification issue. The only way you reconcile those two statements, the judge never took back that last sentence. He never said, I didn't mean that, or that's not what I meant. He just threw in this, I consider all the evidence. Of course, at that time, who knew what was going to be appealed or what? And there was all kinds of issues in front of the court, all the way from alimony to child support, custody, and everything else. So, you know, you have to reconcile those two statements. And if you're going to take a trial court to mean what it says, then that sentence they wrote in that opinion says that he was, Judge Klein was saying, that's what governed the issue. That's what he wrote. And this spin to try and, you know, to try and take all this other evidence, which on this limited issue about the apportionment of the gain, the court rejected all of it on this issue. Maybe not on other issues, like on valuing whether the company was worth $11 million or whatever. The court didn't reject it on that. But on, as to this issue, the apportionment of the gain, the court in its letter opinion blew it all up, paragraph after paragraph after paragraph, went through and said, that didn't work, that didn't work, that didn't work. You know, Joubert didn't explain to me how things changed before or after marriage and how I'm supposed to apportion this. He specifically wrote, other than the testimony of Joubert and Canizella and Martin's classification of the interest of the report, there was little evidence on which the court could potentially rely in analyzing whether Mr. Joubert had satisfied his burden of proof. That's on page 1381. Then he said, although I thought Joe, I already quoted this, although Joubert was credible, he didn't differentiate. And then he said, nothing Joubert Canizella provided a sound factual predicate for the analysis undertaken in the Martin report, which was the attempt to classify. So he said, nothing Joubert or Canizella gave me the ability to do anything. And then he went on to say, you know, Martin tried to say something about general market value. You know, he tried to use the Roe situation with the Fredericksburg where the population went up and the value of the newspaper went up. And he said, well, Martin doesn't understand how, you know, patent world works, so I'm not going to consider any of that. And then the court went on and he said, the court strongly disagrees with Martin's conclusion that Mr. Joubert's personal efforts have had no effect on the appreciation of the non-operating assets of RLM. So he rejected Martin's opinion on his personal efforts, right? Which is how he finally, and then he said, you know, market values have all kinds of variables, and that's how he got to this, equity percentage governs my decision. Which is crazy. That's just not what anybody has held. And our attempt is not to discount any cases. I think your honors ought to look at David, the Supreme Court's last pronouncement on this. They said, the court presumes the legislature has purposely chosen the precise statutory language. We're bound by those words when we apply the statute. The General Assembly uses specific language in one place but omits it in another. When addressing similar subjects elsewhere in the code, we must presume the difference in choice of language is intentional. Which means when the General Assembly uses the word causation, it's different than some 11-factor ED test. You have to prove causation. I don't think that burden of proof has been met.
So, quick question.
Yeah.
You don't dispute that Judge Klein did have David before him and, in fact, considered David.
The case?
The case.
I think he talked about it.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
And our relief is stated in our brief, the relief we're looking for.
Thank you.
Okay.
We're coming down to Greek council, and then the court's going to take about a 20-minute